Today's episode of Motherfuck Lore is brought to you by the show's supporters on Patreon. Patreon supporters get access to a range of bonus features and other benefits, as well as the pleasure of keeping the Motherfuck Lore podcast coming to you every week. Patreon supporters such as Jason Wade and Kirsten Nelson have brought the show to you today. Karan Milmagov, Jason, August, Kirsten. And now, the show. From the Hestuff Podcast Network, welcome to Motherfuck Lore, a podcast of words, Irish words, and words from Ireland. I'm Dara O'Shea. I'm thrilled today to talk to a very special guest, someone I've wanted to have on the show for a while, about back in late 2018, Clodagh and I did an episode on a Scots Gaelic book that I found, which is all called An Luath Léir, which is a book on transgressive Scots Gaelic verse. One of the poems in particular we read out on the episode. It got a huge response. It also got a huge response when I shared it on Twitter. Its translated title is I Dreamt With You Last Night. The poet was Niall O'Gallagher. He is on board Fála Clásgu, which is the poet in residence in the Gaelic language for the city of Glasgow. He is my guest today. Fála to Niall.
Gramaigad dach.
How are you getting on today?
Fine. Really fine. I mean, everybody's safe. Everybody's healthy. It's been quite intense for the past wee while because my wife and I have been working at home with two small kids, but nothing to complain about. Everything's fine.
How have you managed straddling your writing, your day job, homeschooling, regular parenting?
I think like most people, it's been back to basics. I haven't really done much writing of poetry in the past 4 months while this has been happening, but that's been okay really because I finished my new book on the last day of 2019. So the pressure's not really been on from that point of view, but it's really just really trying to juggle it between us, you know. So one of us would take one of the wains out on the bike while the other tries to get through some schoolwork, and then everyone has to go into the front room. Well, I work as a journalist, so I'd be on the radio, and then I'll be broadcasting in the next room while something else is happening in the back room. And I think everyone just kind of muddling on, you know. And I've kind of been saying, you know, to my colleagues on BBC Radio and Gael that if they hear the kids, then that's just going to happen. There's no stopping them. You know, like since they've been very small, we've managed to stop them more or less from making their debut on the morning news. But one of these days it's going to happen, and I'm just relaxed a bit now. People can't expect anything different like this under these circumstances.
So I have to ask you, obviously, as a journalist, and during the pandemic when a lot of people have been broadcasting from home, a strange trend has happened where people have curated their bookshelves behind them to present themselves in a highly intellectual, yet accessible kind of way.
I've been broadcasting in front of my bookshelves more or less every night on BBC Alapa, which is the kind of Scottish equivalent of TG Cahir. And that's where all the politics news has been coming from, is from my front room in front of these books. But I honestly haven't changed the books around much. I mean, you take a few things off the shelf that are maybe family photos, or you take away bits and pieces that are too personal. But basically, it's just my poetry bookshelf, or mine and Claire's poetry bookshelf. So I haven't really curated it. Maybe people were expecting that what they would see is lots of biographies and history and all this stuff, whereas it's just collected poems of Seamus Heaney and collected poems of Edward Morgan and et cetera, you know. So I come over as exactly what I am, which is a poetry geek and someone who is quite bookish. But, you know, that's just, in my case, and that's just me, you know.
Because obviously some people have been talking away and people have scrutinized their bookshelves. Interesting. And now that we live in the age of the screen grab, where people can zoom right in and say, look, this person has a biography of Mao Zedong. You know, we always knew they were, you know, this way or inclined. And people read books by people they don't like. But it's been an interesting process. And some people have clearly, you know, curated their bookshelves in a particular way to emphasize their own beliefs or to cultivate that. But it's been a funny phenomenon.
Yeah, the other thing is that the laptop that you're using to broadcast with on Skype has to be kind of stood up on about six thick books. So actually some of the nicest books are the ones you can't see. They're the ones that are propping up the computer, because they're the ones that are thick enough to actually do the job.
That's the funny thing, because people said, yes, if people knew, by the way, these are the books that I'm stacking the laptop on, and you might have all your kind of your poetry in the shelf behind you and all your Jeffrey Archers under your laptop.
That's right, absolutely.
So now this is your third collection is coming out this year, and you've sent me some of the work inside it. It's an exciting book with a definitely deserving of a wide audience. You have chosen to write in Scots Gaelic. And you have made a very big point to not translate your own work. This is something that is a position shared by one of Ireland's great poets, Biddy Jenkinson. And I just wanted to know, you've written about this, and do you want to explain your position, why you choose not to do this?
Yeah, I mean, I don't go as far as Biddy Jenkinson, who I really admire a lot as a poet. I mean, Biddy's position is that she doesn't want her poetry translated into English in Ireland at all. Mm-hmm. And I've not gone that far. I mean, I've been quite inspired by the approach that people like Gallery Press take, and the poets like Nolan O'Gonnell have been able to do, where they write the poetry in Irish and then other poets do the translating.
Yeah.
And the issue is that in Scotland, that's just much harder to achieve because there are fewer people who are literate in Gaelic who could do that. You know, fewer English language writers who have good enough Gaelic to be able to do that work. I've been very, very lucky in that I've been able to work with some good friends who are excellent poets in both languages, Peter Mackay and Deborah Moffat. So they've translated a good number of my poems. But I took the decision earlier on when I started doing this that I wasn't going to translate my own work. And there's so many reasons for it. You know, some of them are kind of small p political, which are about saying, you know, every poem that I translate myself into English is one fewer reason for people to learn Gaelic, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't really want to be part of that, part of giving people fewer reasons to learn this language that I love. But others are more kind of practical in terms of going about writing poetry. And I think that for me, if I'm writing a poem, especially the way I write poems, which I'm quite old-fashioned, I like to rhyme and have regular meter and so on. I think if I was writing those poems knowing I was going to have to rewrite them in English when I was finished, that would be just really, you know, oppressive, really limiting.
Yes.
Because instead of going for the best rhyme in Gaelic, I'd be going for the thing that I thought was going to work in two languages. I just think that's an impossible test for any poem to pass. And there are friends of mine, I mean, Peter Mackay is a good example. He does do that. He works in both languages. And to him, it's a straitjacket the way that a straitjacket is a straitjacket for Houdini. You know, it's just a pretext to this display of skill and so on. But my point is just that it shouldn't be forced on people. I think that if we're going to have this position of equality between these languages, then we need to be able to say, no, I'm going to write this poem in the language I'm going to write it in. These are the words I'm going to write it in. And leave it at that. And actually, you know, that was a position when I started out. But since then, it's really not been a problem because I've been able to find readers and, you know, people have come to the poetry and people have translated the poetry. So, it, you know, it hasn't kind of in any way, I think, held the poems back in terms of them finding an audience. But it's also meant that I've been able just to get on with what I wanted to do instead of worrying all the time about how it was going to come over in English.
For sure. And I can really see that because I think when a poem can stand a number of different interpretations, and when you're translating it yourself, you're picking one interpretation, and it contradicts the poet's greater mission. And I think also the, you know, writing is such a solitary experience. The idea that, you know, to have somebody else do that translation as well, and as well, like that they are basically kind of lifting you and you're lifting them by having that kind of a shared literary experience. That's something writers generally don't get to have.
I mean, the other thing about it as well is that I've also had poems translated into Irish.
Oh, yes.
So by Owen McIlibrige, who is a very well-regarded short story writer. I'm sure that some listeners would know his name and know his work. And he's done wonderful Irish language versions of poems of mine. And that's quite fascinating because obviously I can read Irish. And that means that you're seeing two new versions of the same poem, one in Irish by Owen, one in English by Peter or Deborah, and they're different because they've chosen different interpretations or because the language they're using has pushed them in a certain way. And I think if I'd have kind of preempted that by doing it myself, then you would have tied their hands, you know. Whereas instead, if you just leave things as they are, at least in my experience, that's worked and that's allowed the poems to kind of go their own way.
And you've translated Irish poems into Scots Gaelic too.
I have. I did a lot of poems by Betty Jenkinson for the first number of a magazine called Stjal, which is a Scottish Gaelic creative writing magazine, and I look after poetry for that magazine. So I've done poems by Betty Jenkinson, which was great, and also in terms of her position on translating. She's not against translating. She just doesn't want her poems translated into English in Ireland. She was very, very happy for me to translate them into Scottish Gaelic in Glasgow. You know, there was no issue there at all. I've also done poems by Seamus Barrow O'Sullivan into Scottish Gaelic, which was really challenging because, I mean, I met Seamus years ago in Godore. We were reading at a festival there. And his poetry and mine, they couldn't be further apart. I mean, he's, you know, a spoken word artist, and he's a slam poet, and he's influenced by hip hop. Whereas my poems tend towards the more classical style, you know. But it's good. The other thing that's good about translating other writers is that you're pushed out of your comfort zone a bit. You know, you're having to try and go, how did he do that? And try and work back and redo it in another language and hopefully learn something along the way.
Yeah, I was just reading some of the work then. The essay in which you explained your position about not wanting to translate your own poetry, it was the English translation of that was Butterfly Hunting, but it was Sealg Dearandé, am I pronouncing
that
right?
That's right, Sealg Dearandé,
Sealg Dearandé. And that is interesting because that is one, Dearandé is, as a butterfly, that's one of the Scots Gaelic words that's different from its Irish equivalent. And for a lot of people, on one level, there's lots of similarities between Scots Gaelic and Irish, but there are differences too, and that's one of them. And it's probably some people listening who are wondering, what's the, like, how different can an Irish and Scots Gaelic version of the poem be? It's obviously quite different, but what was that like translating Irish into Scots Gaelic?
It's really difficult because, I mean, you don't have to go too far back until you're really dealing with one language, at least in the literary tradition. And as a reader of poetry and as a writer of poetry, I'm constantly going back to earlier poetry. I mean, when you get back into the 1600s or before, from my perspective, you're not really talking about Irish or Scottish poetry. You're just talking about poetry that's Gaelic and which belongs to a tradition that is shared. You know, it's in a literary language, which wasn't a language that anyone necessarily spoke, but a language that was used by poets. And so what's funny about it is the two languages are kind of, they overlap so much. That, for example, when I was translating Betty Jenkinson was hard because, I mean, obviously I speak Scottish Gaelic, right? But I'm not a walking dictionary, do you know? Yeah. I don't know all the words. So there'd be words that she would use in Irish, and just because I haven't heard an equivalent word in Scottish Gaelic doesn't mean it doesn't exist in the record of the language, you know?
Yeah.
So there's this level of which every Irish word is potentially also a Scottish Gaelic word already, just one I haven't learned yet. So that just adds in this extra complication, and then you kind of have to kind of make this decision about how close to the Irish am I going to keep it. You know, and as someone with an Irish background like mine, who is always keen to emphasize the closeness rather than the difference of the two forms, you're kind of pushed instinctively in that direction. But at the same time, I want people to be able to read it. And so you've got in your head, you've got the kind of day-to-day vernacular. So you've got to just make these choices, and it is complicated, you know. But I suppose what translating is really about when it's from Irish to Scottish Gaelic is about saying, look at this, this is great. You really should read this. It's a kind of an activism in terms of our readers and saying, this is great poetry, and maybe I can be some kind of a bridge, you know, between Irish language poetry and Scottish Gaelic poetry, and point to the things that I'm reading just for pleasure in Irish and enjoying, and kind of bring them over a bit.
I can really see that, because even like I know Irish, I don't know Scots Gaelic that well, but when I read your poems in translation, I can see the English version, then I look to see, what must that word be in Scots Gaelic, and then I can see the words that I recognise and the words that I don't, or the words that I recognise as being something else, like once when you may say a heel meaning your love or my love, and I see that I recognise, you know, that looks a bit like, a little bit like Collie, and a little bit like Calloch, a little bit like some of these words, which I recognise in Irish, but it has a very different semi-related meaning here. And it is fascinating. It sends me down wonderful wormholes.
I don't think you always have to understand everything to enjoy it either. You know, I think there's always a stage at reading a poem of not really quite getting it, you know? And I quite enjoy that.
That stage is really underrated, the point where you don't actually understand things, but you're having a nice time.
Yeah, and I also, just speaking personally, I like to read very slowly, and I like to, kind of as a calming thing, I like poetry which makes me read very slowly. I like having to reach for the dictionary. Maybe that makes me different from other readers, but that's one of the things that poetry kind of does for me, is it allows me to slow down, have a space where you can slow down. When you're writing poetry and people come up to you, I mean, one of the things is you're writing poetry in Scottish Gaelic, which is a language under pressure, if you can put it kind of no more dramatically than that. Then, you're reaching for all these words that are out of use or haven't been in regular use, or maybe just people don't know, or whatever it happens to be. And one of the reasons you're doing that is because I'm writing to rhyme, so I need to find a rhyme word, you know.
Yes.
But people have said to me that, I didn't know that word, but I like that word. I'm going to start using that word now. So maybe, in a small way, you can maybe bring things. I'm not making a big claim to this as one writer, but maybe in this kind of exercise of bringing things into poetry, which is not like an everyday thing, but it's a special place for language, maybe it can then find its way into the everyday language too.
Yeah, that's definitely something. And you mentioned these words finding their way into the everyday language. One of your poems, and I know you do mention dictionaries a bit, which I am going to get back to. One of your poems is about, in the new collection, is about dandelions, or has a title of dandelion. Obviously, it's about much more than that. But the Irish for dandelion is Caoimhir Bhán.
Yeah.
The Scottish Gaelic is a bit prettier.
It's Bearn an Bríde. Which means something like St. Bride's Little Gapped Flower.
Bride's Little Gapped Flower. That's
because Bearn is a gap. So Bearn an, the little gapped one of St. Bride. Bearn an Bríde. And it's in Dineen's dictionary as well, But I think I was saying to you before that one of the things that about this poem is really about is it's about, since I've had children, I've had to learn all these new words for things that I didn't know before and didn't have any cause to need to know before,
Yes.
And because my daughter would say to me things like, "Igadi, Jay Gallicky, Dad, what's the Gaelic for X, Y, or Z?" and point to this flower. And so I find myself racking my brains and trying to find, the words for these things or looking them up. And then that they make their way into the poem as Bearn an Bríde is the flower, the beautiful flower, but the flower that no one really pays any attention to. It's normally considered a weed,
Yes.
But that's where that comes from.
That's fantastic, because that is something we get so many, I guess, parents in contact with the show who want to rediscover Irish so they can share it with their children. And then even that, just the actual, like being able to, I know from my father was able to recognize bird songs and flowers that wouldn't always know the name for. And the fact that this is a part of Gaelic languages that is particularly accessible, because these names are so beautiful.
They're beautiful. They're absolutely beautiful. I mean, one of my favorites. The book is called Fovla, which Irish speaking listeners will know means in bloom. And the whole first section of the book is just flower poems and poems about trees and poems about fruit, And I think the book's like a kind of an overgrown, unruly garden, of these poems. And things like the Scottish Gaelic word for the flower we call a bluebell in English is Brog na Cuaige, which is the cuckoo's shoe.
The cuckoo's shoe. That's gorgeous.
It's just beautiful, isn't it? I mean, and there's all these kinds of things. And particularly, obviously, because we're talking about these languages, they're words for the things that grow here. I'm really into all that. I'm really interested in all that. I'm really interested in finding, the words for things, and also just having to do with the chip with the kids is where the poems have come from, at least in the first part of the book.
Yeah, that's really something. I know there are these little like red flowers that I think they're probably like poppies, but not quite. But I always recognize them. I never know what the word is, and I know they were technically weeds, but a weed is just like a, it's kind of like a botanical loanword. It's just a plant in the wrong place,
or that's right, of course.
What someone just decided to be in the wrong place.
Yeah.
And some of them are very lovely. So you are the Bard, Vale Glasgow, the writer in residence, the poet, Gaelic poet in residence for the city of Glasgow. This is something that's been a long tradition of, but maybe a recent tradition of, but specifically for the Scots Gaelic language.
That's right, yeah.
How did this come about?
I got a phone call one day last summer. I mean, I think partly what happened was I had written my first book of poems, Bea Uair, which is really a book of Glasgow love poems. And that kind of brought my poems to the attention of the people who were looking for somebody who could occupy this role. It was a big kind of year for Gaelic in the city, 2019, because the Mod, which is I think the Scottish equivalent of the Oireachtas, was in town for the first time in I think 30 years or so, and so there was a lots of kind of thinking about how, as a city and as a Gaelic speaking community in Glasgow, we were going to celebrate that, and so I was asked to do this, which was wonderful kind of honour for me. The other thing, what they asked me to do was they asked me to write three poems. They didn't say, you know, what kind of poems or what subject the poems had to be. So I was kind of, it was left wide open to me, but I had this understanding of, you know, I was going to have to do something that was connected to the city in some kind of meaningful way. And it was quite a challenge for me because I'd never kind of had a civic commission like that before. I've always just written for joy. And a lot of my poems are very domestic and very, you know, very private in a way. So I had to sit and think, how am I going to write something that is kind of good enough for this occasion, but also which is kind of meaningful to me and isn't just, you know, a bit of journalism in verse? You know, I really didn't want to do that because I make my living as a journalist. So I wanted to do something else.
Yes.
And where I ended up with was I went right back to the kind of founding story of the city of Glasgow, which is about two saints, St. Mungo and St. Enoch. Mm. And the story turns out, I mean, it's such an old story that it's a mythical, you know, it's not a historical story, it's a mythical story. Yes. But what the story is really about is it's about a woman who is expelled from her home by her father because her father learns she's pregnant. So she is an unmarried single mother, a refugee. She's alone on a boat at sea and washes up on a new shore where she doesn't speak the language. And the child that she's carrying goes on to be St. Mungo, who will build the city of Glasgow. And I just looked at this stuff and I thought, how of today, how of this particular moment is this story?
Yes, absolutely. That's what I was about to say.
Absolutely contemporary and urgent is this story. It also resonated with me. And one of the things I was conscious of is that Glasgow's got a massive Gaelic-speaking community. Glasgow has been, in Scotland, when speaking Gaelic, we call Glasgow Ballymore na Gael, you know, the city of the Gaels.
Wow.
And that's what we call it, you know, because really since the 19th century, since, you know, the Glasgow we know today happened because of Gaelic-speaking immigration and Irish-speaking immigration in the 19th century. And there's a very, very big Gaelic-speaking community. There's a big Irish-speaking community as well in Glasgow, as we know.
Mm, yes.
But I was conscious that, you know, I was appointed as someone from an Irish and not a Scottish Gaelic background to this position. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how do I fit into this story, you know? And but it resonated with me as someone whose family came to Glasgow from Ireland, you know, in the 19th century. On one side, the other side of my family are still in Derry. So I thought the whole immigrant story was something that could resonate with me personally, as well as being something that would mean something to the Glasgow Gaelic community more widely, who are all, if we go back a few generations, from somewhere else, but then in Glasgow, everyone's from somewhere else if you go back far enough, you know.
Yeah.
And I couldn't stop. And this is one of the reasons why the book is late. the book was interrupted by the arrival of these poems because they asked me for three, but I couldn't stop. So I wrote 12. And so this is a sonnet sequence in the second half of the book. And I wrote the last one on the last day of last of 2019.
Fantastic. And you found that this, having the civic role as having kind of the official, a bard of the city, the engagement with the public was a positive experience?
The whole thing has been wonderful for me. Mm-hmm. I think, I mean, I started writing the poems almost immediately. I think, you know, as a writer, they ask you to do lots of things. They ask you to do things in public and everything else. But really, being a writer is about being alone writing. And but I got started pretty quick. And once I found that I could write in a way that, you know, about these subjects, which actually excited me, then everything became straightforward after that, because I was, you know, when I was invited to read in places, then I would have new things that were relevant to read. So it's been wonderful, and it meant that I've been able to take these poems to places that I wouldn't have been able to take them before. I also think it's a step forward for me, because one of the things that it kind of pushed me into doing was not writing in my own voice.
Yes.
You know, and I have done some of this sort of thing before, but I don't think it matters too much if the reader thinks it's me or not in the poems, but I always thought it was me in the poems speaking, you know. Mm-hmm. But in these poems, I started writing in persona, in personae, and that was wonderfully freeing, you know.
Of course.
To be able to write about things, say things that you couldn't say in your own voice, and try and look at things in a way that you wouldn't have been able to look at them. Also in our language as well, you know, like, it kind of freed me up in terms of the breadth of the language I felt I could use. I could be a little bit more old-fashioned in places if I wanted to be, and use kind of turns of phrase that might sound a little bit, you know, in my own voice, like a little bit too high or a little bit too pompous, maybe, I don't know, because they belong to, you know, older registers of the language. But when I was writing in these voices, all of a sudden that became acceptable, at least to my ear, you know. And so you could really broaden out what you were doing.
For sure. And I can see it for a lot of poets, particularly poets of your generation, who are there's, you know, like every other kind of cultural movement, there are certain trends that are popular or that have gone up unpopular. And there are things that where you might find that, say, there's a move towards free verse, you know, and a lot of or certain very performance driven kind of poetry is kind of quite popular, and you've chosen to use kind of maybe slightly older forms. Some people find the structure of sonnets and alexandrines and those other kind of forms actually to be quite freeing.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, the other thing it does is it just helps. I mean, I don't really know anything about painting, but I kind of imagine that one of the first things a painter has to do is to choose the canvas they're going to paint on and what the dimensions of the canvas are going to be.
Yeah.
And a sonnet helps me because I know what space I'm working within. But it's also just really about, you know, I think your tastes as a writer are follow on from your tastes as a reader. And I've always loved poetry in strict form and in rhyming poetry. But certainly in Scottish Gaelic poetry, as it happens, free verse has been the kind of dominant form. Things getting increasingly various and rich and diverse, but there was a time when free verse was what everyone was doing, more or less, and it just wasn't going to work for me.
Yes.
But I think that one of the advantages of writing in these kind of strict forms is that people's expectations change. You know, like I think when you're reading a poem, and the trouble with free verse is that it looks or sounds too much like ordinary speech. And therefore, if you use words or forms of the language which don't really sit well in ordinary speech, then that can trip people up. And people who write free verse well can use those effects and do that deliberately and can surprise and startle and do all that. But I think that if you're writing in strict form, people's associations immediately change, and they're not expecting it to sound like free, like speech. They're expecting it to sound maybe more like song, or even like prayer. I don't think that these are particularly religious poems, but I think, you know, that's one of the things that kind of can resonate with people. And so that's good in a situation where if the language is under pressure, then it's a way of helping push back against that and allow yourself to reach for a wider range of language because the form seems to allow it.
Absolutely. Something that I've noticed has been recurring in some of your poems is the idea of dictionaries turning up. You mentioned, you know, that best dreaming with you, not of you, as they say in Catalonia, as one of your dictionaries and your new poems. You mentioned about the dandelions looking for words. This is something that seems to occur, and you've mentioned that maybe the resources, the lexicographical resources available to a Scots Gaelic speaker or writer are different than those available to someone using Irish.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a professional linguist, but my kind of sense is that just that the written form of Scottish Gaelic is just less standardized and actually just less used, if we're honest, than written Irish and standard written Irish. Which is not to say that spoken Scottish Gaelic is any richer than spoken Irish. I don't think that's true. It's just to say that there are gaps in the written language through underuse. And when it comes to writing, especially when you're writing just in Gaelic and not with anything else to help you out, we don't have a dictionary like the Waldron's Dictionary, you know, a standard dictionary where you can just reach and say, you know, what's the word for this? I mean, I think that, you know, in Scottish Gaelic circles, if a conversation which starts with what's the word for this immediately becomes a discussion about, well, I would say this and he would say that and my granny would say something else.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that happens in vernacular Irish circles too. But there's also in Ireland the option of, well, the word for this is just whatever the dictionary says it is. You know? And in a way, as a writer, sometimes you want to get into all the possibilities, but sometimes you just want to know what the word is and move on. That's not an option we've got right now in Scottish Gaelic. So I spend a lot of time with the dictionary. But that dictionary is Edward Dwelly's Scottish Gaelic Dictionary, which is a wee bit like, I suppose, the Dineen of Scottish Gaelic. It's a really rich resource full of all kinds of arcane and wonderful descriptions. And so it's not really a modern dictionary in the way we would now expect a dictionary to be, but it's a great treasure trove. And I just think there's no way around it. I think that's where you've got to go if you're looking for ways ahead.
It's good to have a resource there. But as you say, I think that on one level, I suppose an authoritative dictionary can be great comfort to the pedant and stuff. It only really becomes a problem. It only becomes a problem when someone tells you that the version your granny uses is wrong or it didn't exist. And
indeed.
Well, I know there's a lot of weight has been added to the fact that Dineen didn't include the word crack in his dictionary.
Oh, right, okay.
And people have jumped to massive conclusions by saying, oh, well because Dineen didn't include crack, we can assume that the word had no existence prior to its appearance in O'Donnell's Dictionary 1977, and therefore isn't a proper Irish word, because we all know proper Irish were only existed before the famine and, you know, God forbid languages evolve or take shape.
Yeah, it's funny because some of my favourite words are kind of relatively modern words, you know. Just because of how beautiful they are. I mean, I love the Irish word for an aeroplane. Eichlan.
Eichlan,
Yeah, Eichlan. Partly because it sounds like the word for a feather.
Yes.
Although I know that it's not derived from that necessarily, but I love these kind of new man-made things. I think we've got this kind of prejudice sometimes against artificial things. I love things that are artificial, you know. I love things which are made by human hands. And I think that can be beautiful in language too. I mean, sometimes I think we can put too much emphasis on authenticity, whatever that means, as opposed to on creativity and on imagination.
I actually agree with you. I think there's something to be said for craftsmanship or craftsmanship and how that comes into the forming of words, and that they're aware of and striking a balance between what's consistent with the heritage and what is useful to a speaker is a delicate craft. It deserves to be respected. It shouldn't be treated as something that's tacky or artificial.
Yeah, and if the alternative is to use an English word, then I'd rather use a new word. And I think in our vernacular speech in Scotland, then more often than not, we would use an English word in ordinary speech for lots of things. Whereas actually I would prefer not to do that. I think, well, let's use the riches of the language and put old words to new uses, and, you know, and it can be unfamiliar to people at first, but people get used to it, you know. I'm all for that sort of thing.
And this is one of the kind of the issues that constantly faces minority languages or kind of early languages that have that interface, specifically the ones that interface with English. Some people think it's like when they look at Welsh, the word for a microwave is popdyping, and they say, well, that's just some Welsh person said, I just don't want to stick the word microwave in an otherwise Welsh sentence. And other people can discuss this, and it's sometimes with mono, when you're talking, dealing with monoglots, you feel like a minority language can't win, because if you compose a new word, they say, well, that's artificial, that's phony. Or if you just take the word, they say, ah, isn't it gas? So you see all these English words popping up for anything that matters. It's it feels like the monoglots have it both ways, or they demand it both ways.
Yeah, and I just think it's none of their business, really. You know,
that's actually a great point.
I just think it's none of their business. It's not for them. You know, it's not a conversation that they need to be part of, to my mind. You know, this is our language that we're using, and we'll use it as suits us. And, you know, we don't need to look over our shoulders and, you know, get the approval of those who, for whatever reason, aren't speaking Irish or aren't speaking Gaelic. You know, if they want to come and join in, then that's great, but I don't think we need to be concerned about what they think. I think we can just leave them to it, you know. Maybe I'm too blasé about these things, but that would be a nice starting point.
Definitely. And before we wrap up, we'd love to ask all our guests what their favourite Irish word is, but if you have a favourite Scots Gaelic word instead or as well, that would be wonderful too.
Well, you know, I think my favourite Irish word for the moment is Aitchelan, just because I think I love the way it sounds, I love the middle consonant, I love the newness of it and the way it echoes the word for a feather. For the moment, my favourite Scottish Gaelic word is Bjarnan Brige for a dandelion, which I just think is so beautiful and so of this place that we live in. And it just appeals to my imagination that something so small and so unvalued, people are usually pulling them up as fast as they can, should have this, not just this beautiful name, but this holy, it's kind of saintly name.
Yes.
And so, you know, value in small things.
That's fantastic. Now, where can people find your work and find out more about you?
So the Gaelic Books Council in Glasgow, if you Google Gaelic Books Council, they have all of what's in print really in Gaelic now, and both of my books are there. The third one will be there soon. There's also some poems on the website of the Scottish Poetry Library, and you'll find some more information about me and some poems there. Hoping the new book will be out in the autumn. And before then, I'm hoping that you might see some poems in Core. I'm hoping that some poems from the new book will appear in Core, either to coincide with or just before the publication of the book, so people can you know, have a look in Core and find a few things there.
Fantastic. We will look forward to those, and we will share them on all our social media channels prior to their release, and we'll put those contact details in the show notes as well. Niall Gallagher, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
So, till the next time, slán go bhfuil. Thank you so much to Niall Gallagher for being such a brilliant guest. Really interesting stuff. I really enjoyed making this episode today, and I hope you enjoyed listening to it. Mother Folklore comes out every Friday on the Hestive Podcast Network. Thank you so much to Brian for doing the production work, and thank you to Kirsten Scheele for doing the artwork. The production of Mother Folklore is made possible by support on Patreon. Patreon members, in addition to keeping Mother Folklore going, get access to certain bonus content. This very week, Patreon supporters got to see a live episode in which I chatted with Oral Nicole, the guest from one of our most popular episodes last year. They were able to submit questions, participate in it, and those Patreons who weren't able to attend live got to have that whole chat released as a bonus podcast episode. And if you're signed up on Patreon now yourself, you can get access to that as well as next week's one. In coming weeks, we are going to be revisiting former guests such as Niamh Lear, Carl Kinsella, and many others. And if you are supporters on Patreon, you can participate in those as well as many other advantages. You can contact the show at motherfolklore@headstuff.org. You can contact Mother Folklore on Twitter. That's our rotation curation account. Or me at the Irish Four. Until the next time, slán go bhfuil.
This has been a production of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
Weather is beautiful. Perfect.